Spurs give Bournemouth a thrashing but end with a broken cane. Man United leave Liverpool fans spitting, while at West Ham, disgraceful scenes no one wants to see on a football pitch as Joe Hart gets the start. Also, supporters run onto pitch and out of patience with the Davids. Hang on though, that's not a pitch invasion. This is a pitch invasion, say Continentals, with big trouble at Lille Montpellier, and even bigger in Greece, with Pauk president chasing ref with a handgun. There's Karma 1, Deeney 0, as Arsenal find their trousers and stop being pants, and great strides too for Newcastle. We ask who scored the weekend's best goal and offer polite smiles all round for Rafa's big bumper Bundesliga update. Lewandowski's going where? The answer will shock you in this Totally Football show. Hey, listeners, how are you doing? We've got Raphael Honigstein for you, as I mentioned.
Hello.
Bringing the noise in a very real sense.
I'll try my best, James.
Ah, lovely. Also here today, Daniel Story.
Good morning, James.
What's the story, Daniel?
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to go for Morning Glory, but...
Well, yeah.
It's a bit base.
But yeah. voice of the Algarve Cup and the CONCACAF Champions League and Chelsea TV, Matt Davis...
That's me. Hello, James.
Hi, Matt.
You were no doubt disappointed, as I was, that the final of the Algarve Cup ended up being called off because of the wet weather. But they shared the trophy, so that was quite nice.
Oh, they're not going to restage it,
no.
Sweden-Holland?
No.
They just said, how do they share a trophy?
I think somebody has it for a couple of months and somebody has it for another couple of months, like in the old Charity Shield, if it finishes as a draw style. But there were wonderful scenes, as you always get, with games that are called off because of a waterlogged pitch, of all the players joining hands, linking arms, and then sliding across the wet pitch in front of the supporters.
Wow. So hang on a sec, this is news to me. So the Community Shield, or Charity Shield, they used to basically just share that if it was a draw.
If it was a draw, there was no penalty shootout, and one team would get it for 6 months, and then the other team would have it for six months. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Almost like it's completely meaningless cup anyway.
Unless your name's Jose Mourinho.
Wow. Speaking of Jose Mourinho, the Farmyard Derby returned this weekend, Man United taking on Liverpool. I know what happened because I read your 16 conclusions, Daniel Story.
Indeed. 16 conclusions?
16.
Always 16, yeah.
Wow. Always 16.
It's more conclusions than shots on goal.
That's true.
By a mile.
Am I right in saying that Pogba out and Rashford in equals Man United's best 45 minutes for a very long time?
Yes, that's probably right. Liverpool were complicit in that. And any team that has a Dejan Lovren playing as Dejan Lovren tends to do on occasions, and will always find it difficult to defend against a brilliant striker like Marcus Rashford. I actually think Manchester United's defending was better there than their attacking. Second half, they were magnificent. Jurgen Klopp said after the game that his team merited a draw, but then also said that they were poor in the crucial moments. And that, to me, is slightly oxymoronic. They had a lot of the ball. They had a lot of territory in the second half. They put Manchester United under pressure, but putting Manchester United under pressure doesn't mean you deserve to draw the game, in my mind. Their goal came from a horrific mistake from Eric Bailly, who was otherwise magnificent. Liverpool have averaged 7.1 shots per second half non-blocked in the Premier League this season. They're generally better in the second half at shooting. They had three against Manchester United, which is, I think, their third lowest of the season, in a game when they had all the ball and Manchester United let them have all the ball. It was the first time since mid-December that Salah's not had a shot on target and Ashley Young was brilliant. Mm. And I think they kind of kept them at arm's length. I think that's as good as anyone has held off Liverpool for a long time. So yeah, I think their defending was better than their attacking.
Although the attacking was pretty good, wasn't it? Rashford looked sensational. Dropped back in his first start of the year and in a massive game. And Lukaku as well, Rafa.
Lukaku is growing into the type of striker that Mourinho needs and wants for his type of game. He wants somebody that is physical, that can lead the line, that he can boot the ball up to. And it almost looked like a choreographed move, the direct flick onto to Rashford, who isolated Trent Alexander-Arnold. And I think the Lovren thing is slightly misleading. I think if Arnold has a good game, nothing really happens. You will lose headers occasionally in midfield. It happens, especially if you come up against Lukaku. Unfortunately, Trent Alexander-Arnold had a really bad game, got done very naively for the first goal, and the second goal turned his back on a curler, which really should never do because there's no pace on the ball. I mean, you don't have to be afraid. Just stand there, cut out the ball, nothing happens. So I think Klopp obviously couldn't say that, couldn't really single him out. But when he talked about the lack of cover and he kind of spoke in code, really what we were saying is that our inexperience was punished a little bit. And I think United had a wonderful game. But it is a wonderful game because the ends justify the means. I think if they concede a goal late on, then United fans would probably scream for Mourinho's head because they played so...
After he'd taken off Rashford for Fellaini.
Yeah, because they were so reactive in the second half. They played like an away team at home. And Liverpool were okay. I don't think they go away from that game feeling too bad about themselves. But I think it brought into sharp relief a little bit that somebody like Coutinho still would have not gone amiss on such an occasion where you come up against such a deep side. If you play against really good players who are willing to sacrifice themselves and the ball and really defend, then it comes to playing that final ball. And Oxlade-Chamberlain didn't really produce that ball. Mane, who played very centrally, I think in recognition that they needed somebody to play that ball, didn't quite play the ball well enough, and that's where things broke down for them.
Even Milner couldn't unlock that Man United defence. When you look at this and you think of the other recent success against a big side at Chelsea, there's no alternative.
No,
we have to praise Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, man. And initially I was thinking it was a Mourinho masterclass, but really it was quite a simple tactic of let's get at Lovren and Alexander-Arnold. United's goals were their only two shots on target
in the match.
Why
doesn't everybody do that then if it's so simple?
Yeah, quite. I mean, I guess Alexander-Arnold has actually had a pretty decent season, hasn't he? So it was unfortunate for him. But yeah, just ruthless efficiency from United. And Marcus Rashford, he does deserve some special praise. He's 7 of his 16 Premier League goals now against big six sides, as you say. So it's kind of a reverse Lukaku thing that he's got going on. And on a weekend where there's lots of concern about the England World Cup squad with Harry Kane and, you know, John Stones not playing, etc., for him to come in and do that was actually quite heartening from an England perspective as well as for Jose Mourinho. And it's good for Mourinho that Rashford played so well, because I thought Sanchez was as anonymous as Mo Salah was in this game.
Here's a stat. Liverpool, when they last won the league, do you know who was 10 years old? Marcus Rashford's dad.
Wow.
Good one.
Crazy, no? Rafa, dare I ask you if Klopp maybe could have done things a little bit better tactically? Playing very narrow, they didn't have a plan B, those kind of things?
I don't know. If after 24 minutes you're 2-0 down, your tactics kind of go out of the window, because you would have come and hoped for United to have a goal and then hit them on the break, and in fact it completely changes around on its head. After 40 minutes you're 1-0 down, after 24 minutes you're 2-0 down. I think the reason why you hear very little disappointment, I think, from the Liverpool fans is because the team kind of showed up afterwards and it didn't feel as if they are falling apart the way they did against City, for example. And they played with some kind of muscularity and with confidence and with presence. They just couldn't break down United defence. But, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a problem of having a plan A or plan B. If a team with so many good players decides to defend so deep and so well, then every team in the world will struggle to find space.
I think the thing that will annoy Klopp most, the incident that will annoy him most, is Virgil van Dijk's missed header in the first half.
Right.
Because he was 4 yards from goal, and that was very soon after the second goal. And if he scores that, the whole impetus of the game changes. And you could see on the touchline, he was shocked that van Dijk had missed that, because that's a chance that he finishes all the time. He basically let it hit him on the shoulder and it went wide. And it was, that kind of changed the game, I think.
Yeah,
fair. And then, point. You know, they could have had a penalty. The Fellaini on Mane one in the second half looked like a penalty to me, so it could have been different.
Could have been different, but it wasn't. Man United then, buoyed by that success, will now take on Sevilla. What's this, Tuesday? 0-0 from the first leg at the Sanchez Pizjuan. Sevilla this weekend losing 2-0 against Valencia. I always feel it's suspicious, worryingly enough, for Man United when a team loses in the league ahead of a Champions League. I don't know why I think that. There's no statistical basis for it. Chelsea, by that token...
It's a ruse.
It's a ruse, yeah. Chelsea, by that token, are in trouble because they went and won against Crystal Palace, and they've got Barcelona. What's the mood like at Chelsea, where you're the official spokesman of Chelsea, Matt?
Yeah.
You're the voice of the Blues. What is your voice sounding like? Optimistic?
I think there is some optimism. I think it's interesting that reports are that Conte is going to seek some consultation from the players as to how he should go for this game. I think the game against Crystal Palace showed the benefit of having specifically Giroud over Morata at the moment because he's in better form, but having a target man. I interviewed Gary Cahill after the game, and he said that the key to Wednesday would be keeping it tight early on. And I sort of wondered if maybe it would be better to try and shock Barcelona by going on the front foot early. Obviously, you risk conceding a goal doing that, but Chelsea are going to need to score in the match anyway.
But if that was his tactics, would he really have said it in public?
Well, quite, yeah, maybe.
Mm. It's mind games, Matt.
Yeah. Well, he fooled me, didn't he?
The victory over Palace was quite narrow in the end, wasn't it?
It was more narrow than it ought to have been. Chelsea could have been three or four goals up by half time because Palace didn't really show up for the first half. But the game completely changed with the introduction of Wilfred Zaha, which is not the first time that somebody would have said that about a Palace game this season. He was excellent to say that he'd been out for a couple of games. Chelsea still lacking a little bit of confidence, obviously, but their approach play is really good. It's just a case they've been unlucky in front of goal. Giroud particularly was in this game. He could quite easily have had a couple hit the post. But generally, Chelsea were obviously way better than they have been in the last two games against Manchester. But as Cahill said, it was all about the win on Saturday. It was a vital game to win. Ideally, to have put some pressure on Spurs, not that they felt it the next day, but I think Chelsea are going to be left rueing those defeats against Watford and Bournemouth.
It's Liverpool that's now getting pressure from Chelsea. They're 4 points ahead of them. Liverpool slipping down to fourth place. Palace, of course, remaining in the bottom three, but they're still only 1 point off safety because basically nobody else apart from Newcastle in the bottom seven actually managed to get a win. As you say, Wilfred Zaha is back now, which is huge. Kabay, Sakho and Loftus-Cheek resuming full training today. Saka was on the bench,
yeah.
Was he?
Yeah.
And they've got a big game coming up against Huddersfield. So what do you think? Are they going to do it against Barcelona?
Heart says possibly, head says no. I think Barcelona have just got a little bit too much for them. But if Chelsea get the first goal, then it changes everything. And I think that, although the team is almost completely different, there will be some stock in the fact that Chelsea have got a very good record against Barcelona. And what happened in 2012, all right, that's getting on for 6 years ago now. But to have won or to have drawn that game 2-2 in the circumstances where they were, Cahill went off in the first 15 minutes of that match. They ended up with 10 men and Jose Bisingua at centre-half and managed to stop Messi from scoring and go through. So you never know. I mean, Barcelona had a pretty routine win at Malaga, who were bottom of the league this season.
Without Messi, who was off with his son being born. Who's going through, Daniel?
Barcelona going through.
Rafa?
Yes. Mm.
Just before
I'm
we
not
finish...
not sure about Sevilla Man United. I still think there's a chance that Sevilla might upset United. I was really surprised how the 0-0 in the first game was feted as the ideal result, completely neglecting the fact that a score draw knocks United out. And I think Mourinho was, for once, genuine when he said Sevilla is a bigger game for us than Liverpool. And I think it's a trickier game in many ways because they'll be under pressure to score but not to concede. It's not a great situation to be in.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power, the home of the Money Back Special. Keep listening to the end of the podcast to find out more.
Mention the race for the top four. Of course, Spurs riding out a difficult afternoon at the Vitality Stadium. 4-1 their win over the Cherries. The big news, Harry Kane, though, doing his right ankle the third time in 18 months.
Prepare for pictures of ankles on tabloid newspapers.
Why do you think it's going to be that bad, Matt?
I don't know. I wouldn't like to speculate. But last time I was here, we were talking, weren't we, about who's nailed on for a starting place in the England World Cup side. And he was one of very few names that we came up with.
That's true. Yeah. He's going to miss, you'd think, the friendlies against Holland and Italy. Last season, he missed 14 matches and two separate injuries to the same joint. But Mark Canary pointing out that Spurs actually played pretty well without him, goals being shared throughout the team, which certainly was the case here, with particular Heung-min Son having another fantastic performance.
And props to Match of the Day's Conor McNamara for the Son scores on Mother's Day line, which I rather enjoyed. Yeah,
that is good. Also, he had a new handshake. Dele Alli incurred the wrath of a lot of right-thinking people when he did his special handshake, but Heung-min Son, everyone loves Heung-min Son.
Yeah, he is the power of a smiling footballer. Mm. Any footballer that looks like they are whistling their way through matches immediately generates a huge amount of goodwill. And in Son's defence, he doesn't just whistle through matches, he also tries very hard. He also produces constantly, and when put into that number nine position, with a little bit of worry in that game from Spurs, 1-0 down, no central striker, he was as good as Kane's been all season.
Yeah, he got a brace away from home as well, because usually he only scores at Wembley.
Seven in four games he's got, which is seven in four games, which is as many as he got in his previous 22. I know he moved into Kane's position yesterday, but you kind of feel like he's responded quite well to Lamella's return, which has obviously put some pressure on his place. But yeah, he's going to keep it if he keeps scoring at the rate he is at the moment.
Indeed.
There's also a really moving interview with him on Al Jazeera after the Juventus game, where he basically was crying on camera. And it's unusual to see a footballer actually being knocked out in the Champions League and it means that much to them. Because a lot of them are sort of smiling afterwards.
Was it like, maybe from when Barzagli stepped on his leg a couple of times?
No, this was afterwards. This was a genuine pain about being knocked out in a game that they could have won. Of course.
I feel rotten that.
Yeah. It's okay, you should. Now, he's lovely, and he is the guy, I think, that surprised me most, because when he was bought from Leverkusen, a lot of people in Germany thought, oh, this is Spurs just being absolutely idiotic, buying this guy who's so flimsy and inconsistent for 30 million euros. What idiots. Stupid English money. Thank you very much. And he's completely changed, I think, in the way he plays, and his efficiency up front has just become marvellous.
Remarkable. Moving across town, here's Mark Finnegan with an interesting stat. David Moyes could get both Sunderland and West Ham relegated and still have a year left on his Man United contract.
That's good. That's one of those tweets that you end up seeing about 25 times because all the great and good enjoyed it. And rightly so. It's great.
Yeah. Right. It,
probably factually incorrect, though.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a seven-year contract with various get-out clauses after certain stages, wasn't it?
What happens is if you're on a contract and you get fired and then you take another job, then that contract is no longer valid. So
killjoy.
Sorry.
Way to
it's very important to get these things right in today's age of fake news and fake memes and all that stuff.
No, you're absolutely right.
I like Rafa as some
West Ham are also 3 points clear of the bottom three, so, you know, as it stands, they're set to stay up. Despite losing 3-0 at home to Burnley. Interesting way to mark the 25th anniversary of Bobby Moore's death, all in all. First off, the performance. That's now three straight defeats. Ten goals conceded. Putting Joe Hart back in didn't work out too well for Moyes.
I'm not sure that was massively Joe Hart's fault.
One of the goals, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I covered the West Ham game at Swansea last week and they were so poor in that I was absolutely amazed. But, you know, it might have been a different game if Pope hadn't saved well from Lanzini at 0-0. And that sort of amplified the problem for Joe Hart, I think, that you had. Burnley's standing goalie, if we can still call Nick Pope that, playing really well at one end and Joe Hart not doing so at the other. But Burnley were really, really efficient with their chances, weren't they? The first two shots on target they had, I think, were both goals. But West Ham, then it all went pretty bad, didn't it?
Then it all fell down, yeah. And a lot of the there seemed to be a message, a general desire from West Ham's players to suggest that the pitch invasion was what threw them off their balance. Do you think that's fair, Daniel?
Yeah, I only if those people have been on the pitch since August. Is that a fair excuse?
Threw Mark Noble off his balance.
Yes, passion for Mark Noble, that is no surprise. It was extraordinary. It was an absolutely extraordinary afternoon. It was the story of the weekend, on a weekend when Manchester United played Liverpool. Nobody's advocating violence. Nobody's advocating storming on the pitch unless you hold a corner flag above your head. That's brilliant. But the way West Ham's owners and the reaction to it of kind of holding their hands up and going, we didn't see this coming, is scandalous. This is a club that is completely complicit in everything that is happening to them at the moment. The owners lied to the fans. They said, Karen Brady came out and said, moving to this stadium will put us in a better position than Tottenham. It said, we'll be able to compete for European football. They spent net 25 million on players since they moved there, which with the increase in broadcast revenues is scandalous. Their planning, if you can even call it that, is non-existent. There's no long-term plan for buying players, for hiring managers, for playing with any sort of shape on the pitch. It's just throw some players on the pitch and hope it works. Some weeks it has worked and most weeks it hasn't. And the fan base are sick of it. They're sick of being lied to. And I really don't like the way we had it with Arsenal where everyone went, oh, Arsenal fans are entitled. They don't deserve to win trophies because there's teams worse off than them, like West Ham. West Ham do it and people say, well, what about Sunderland? If any fans should be protesting, it should be Sunderland.
And
Sunderland,
Leighton Orient.
Yeah, and Sunderland do it. And then they go, well, Hartlepool are collapsing down the road. So how there's always someone worse off than you. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't be allowed to protest.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. Obviously, some of the protests overstepped the line.
Of course,
quite literally.
Yes.
Four separate pitch invasions and the angry scenes, and supposedly one of the, I think, was it David Sullivan hit by a coin, which may well prove handy actually. and the iconic shot of Trevor Brooking, which I think upset everybody.
Of course, and you feel sorry for Trevor Brooking, but his anger, and he came out and said that, you know, the scenes were deplorable, and they were, but his anger. Some of his anger will be reserved for those people in charge who, you know, someone like Brooking should be involved in the decision-making of that club rather than the three people they have who are just, you know, leaders by complete non-example. And, yeah, I think they're going down and I think they deserve to go down and I don't think the fans deserve them to go down. And, no, of course, they shouldn't protest on the pitch. Of course, they shouldn't try and storm a director's box. But anyone at West Ham that looks at that and goes, well, we didn't really see this coming, has had their eyes closed for 8 months.
I felt sorry for the supporters in the stands, actually, not the ones on the pitch, because they had the sort of the double hit, didn't they? They saw what was going on with their own supporters spoiling the game, making people uncomfortable, people coming back and then fights breaking out in the stands. You know, you've got people who would have been going to Upton Park or wherever for 30 years plus, and this was, as Daniel says, this is just not what they were sold. You know, right from the very start of them moving to the London Stadium, you'd have thought the first thing they would have done would be buy a marquee player to put in that side. You know, okay, this is our new stadium. This is how serious we are. Here's our 40, 50 million pound player.
Chicharito, I suppose, was the closest we came to that.
But they sold Dimitri Payet, who was their marquee player.
But that wasn't entirely their choice, I guess. I mean, he essentially said that he would.
The idea of a fan base wanting to win trophies is a complete misnomer to me. West Ham fans don't expect to win trophies or expect to finish in a certain league position, just like Arsenal don't. What they expect is to have a club where they can be confident that the people running the show have the best interests of the club at heart and have everyone pointing in the right direction. And at the moment, at West Ham, everyone's facing each other and fighting each other and nothing's moving forward at all.
So, well, everyone's head off to Miami for warm weather training.
Indeed, yes.
It's a great idea.
Haven't been any issues with warm weather training this season.
It worked well for David Moyes at Sunderland, didn't he, when he went off to... Oh, no, hang on, it didn't, did it?
Basking in the club with the heaters on. That we're doing. That's bad, isn't it?
Burnley, well done, Burnley. That's their first away win since November.
Rafa?
Yeah, no, for sure.
Well, Karen Brady wrote a column in 2011 predicting a wonderful future for West Ham and also welcoming back the World Cup winning team of England under Harry Redknapp in 2014. Unfortunately, that column is no longer online. The columns either side of that one are online. So if anyone's got it, please send it forward.
Gold. So basically, by 2014, England have won the World Cup, and West Ham
have half the team because
European giants.
Yeah, there's all.
Redknapp has a statue.
Yeah.
Wow.
You've read that, Danny, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have that, please, please get in touch. Burnley, anyway, their first win away since November. Only four shots on target, three goals. Do West Ham face repercussions in terms of points docked and matches behind closed doors?
My guess is a massive fine.
Because it's not the first time they've had trouble there. I mean,
no, but never on the pitch, which is what they'll be charged with.
Okay.
My hunch is a massive fine and a suspended behind closed doors.
It would have
sentence.
Been different, I think, if one of the Burnley players would have been hurt or if the referee would have had to take the players off.
Right.
But they dealt with it quite coolly. So,
But you almost feel like they need something like a stadium ban or a points deduction to address the issues that there are with the stadium as regards to the setup of the stewarding and the fact that, you know, when they first moved there, they had fans who wanted to be rowdy mixed in with supporters who wanted to sit and watch the game and all this kind of thing. And you sort of feel like if they got a, you know, if they get a 50 grand fine or whatever, they can say, oh, well, you know, we'll try and learn from it. But if they were actually hit with some serious thing like a stadium behind closed doors game or a couple of points deductions, then, okay, this is something we seriously need to look at. We're paying this group of stewards, you know, somewhere around minimum wage and then expecting them to go on and tackle people who might be members of the intercity firm or whatever. And Why would you? There's a really good article by John Nicholson on Daniel's site today about this. And it just seems like it's an easy way for clubs to pass responsibility. Well, the stewarding's not our issue. We subcontract that out to somebody else. And it's just classic buck passing, really.
There are a number of West Ham supporters who will consider a stadium ban as some sort of reward after the last few games. I don't think anything helps them at the moment. I think they are doomed.
They're running going down, says Daniel's story.
Yeah, the running's dismal as well.
Brady-esque.
Yeah, call to arms to Karen Brady.
You wonder what the solution is here, because they're not an attractive takeover target, not having a stadium that is viable, really, for football, that anyone wants to really go and see a game. I would suggest yeah. Yeah.
I don't know, Rafa. They got a massive stadium.
Oh, but it's...
And they get it rent almost... I mean, they get it for a peppercorn rent. And apparently, I was reading today, that the rent actually is reduced if they do go down to the Championship, as they will, says Daniel's story. But do go on.
No, it might be that it's a good business case, but as a sort of a proposition for someone who gets excited about doing anything in football and wants it maybe as a kind of soft power move because you happen to represent an autocratic regime somewhere in a horrible area of the world, it just doesn't really strike you as very attractive. With those fans having all these issues, and these issues will not go away as long as they're in that stadium, which they absolutely detest. So it's not great.
Wow.
And it's sort of seen as a cautionary tale for the likes of Everton and Chelsea and Spurs, to a lesser extent, clubs who are looking to move stadiums in the near future. But the difference is that they're moving into grounds built for football.
Right.
And West Ham are in an athletic stadium.
Crowd trouble, anyway, wasn't only at London Stadium. There were ugly scenes at Lille Montpellier. The Lille players forced to flee the pitch at the Stade Pierre Mauroy. After their 1-1 draw with Montpellier, their own fans, who were a little bit upset, again, sold a dream, living a nightmare. They're down in the relegation zone and second bottom, actually. At that point, not a huge help to them. But all of that paled in comparison to what happened at the PAOK Salonika against AEK. Apologies if I've mispronounced that game this weekend in the Greek Super League. Did you see this, Rafa?
I did not see it, but I saw the pictures of the PAOK president. With
his handgun.
Yeah.
Open carrying. Yeah. So Charles Duxbury, hello to you, Charles, by the way, had the background, which he very kindly, you know, detailed exactly what the context for this was. Pau, who were in a title race with AEK and Olympiakos, had been deducted after problems at their match with Olympiakos when the opposition manager got hit by an object thrown from the crowd. With the 3-point deduction, they were 7 points behind the leaders, AEK, who they played this weekend. Also, they had fans banned and their stadium closed for this weekend's match. But literally hours before the game, all that was reversed. Fans were allowed in the stadium and they moved back to 4 points behind AEK. The game is goalless until the 89th minute when PAOK score, and now they're only 1 point off the top. Referee gives goal, everybody celebrates. But about 2 minutes later, the referee disallows the goal after talking to a linesman a couple of minutes afterwards. The PAOK president storms onto the pitch with three bodyguards. The officials make a run for it. Fans riot. The game gets suspended. The president comes back, this time with the gun, which he might have had. He's taken his coat off. Now everyone can see he's carrying. And AEK then refused to go anywhere near the pitch again. But PAOK finished the evening off by saying that the referee had changed his mind again and re-awarded the goal. Not surprisingly, perhaps, in the circumstances.
You would, wouldn't you?
Would. And now it's 1-0. If you look on the Greek Super League website, it does say 1-0 to PAOK for the moment, which means that they are very much back in the title picture.
Until they have 12 points deducted in a week's
Absolutely,
time.
Absolutely, yeah. They possibly might revisit their decision about the Olympiakos game as well, which could see them come back into the title picture as well. Also, Greek police have apparently issued a warrant for the arrest of the PAOK owner Savidis and his three bodyguards.
Actually, Mayan Matt's.
If only they planted a corner flag in the middle of the pitch instead.
Well, Mayan Matt's football club, Nottingham Forest, our new owner is Evangelos Marinakis, who's the former Olympiakos owner, and he was on, I'll be careful how I phrase this, but he is on charges of match fixing and burning down a referee's bakery.
Oh.
In response to a penalty decision given last minute. So it's fair to say that Greek chairman owners have form for this sort of thing.
Did he take a handgun to the fit and proper test meeting?
Yeah. Luckily, you don't need to, apparently. He, wow. I mean, he is more fit and proper than our former owner, which helps.
Speaking of Arsene, everybody, Wenger in. 2-0 against Milan on Thursday, 3-0 against Watford on Sunday. Is this their classic late season, a little bit too late to actually win things run, or something bigger? I bet you believe, don't you, Rafa?
Believe in what? I think they could win the Europa League.
Yeah.
The way things are falling. I think there's only Atletico Madrid really as one team that would frighten them at this point. Dortmund look as if they get knocked out. Leipzig aren't that great. If they can vote Atletico, they can do it. They can even beat Atletico over one leg, although I'd make Atletico favourites with Griezmann being back in form. But yeah, it's viable. Whether that will be enough for the board to, you know, to take a view that everything that they've seen gone wrong this season actually now is magically kind of didn't exist or is rectified, or we can believe in a better future on us. Wenger, I'm not so sure.
So does Wenger actually face the board at the end of this season?
He himself admitted it, that there is a kind of review going on. But I think he was also basically saying that this is just a advisory kind of situation where no one's going to actually stand up to him and say, well, you are getting fired, that it is still his decision whether he honors that contract. I think it could have been a situation where if they'd kept on losing games, get knocked out against Milan, that we wouldn't have seen a West Ham type situation, but the resistance to Wenger staying for another year would have been so great that even passive owners like Kroenke and his son would have said, okay, we don't want that kind of toxicity,
right?
And we need to make a decision. But I think as long as they can somehow pretend that everything is more or less okay, they're reluctant to get rid of Wenger. And I think the thing is, what we should never forget is that people that are in charge there, you know, Gazidis and all the players, they all owe so much to Wenger that they're all very reluctant to be the guy who sticks the knife in. Mm. You just want him to do that himself.
Right. What do you think is behind Arsenal's kind of two-game revival? Is it Ozil being allowed to, not having Sanchez treading on his toes anymore?
The Watford game was kind of an aside. Watford were pretty poor in the first half.
But they looked great, for example, at San Siro.
Yeah, they did.
Admittedly, against a team with Borini, Suso and Kalinic up front.
I think the interesting thing now, and the thing that helped him, is that Wenger, for as long as he could, kind of ignored the idea of sacrificing the Premier League and focusing only on the Europa League. He saw that as an admission of weakness, and he's not very good at doing that. He has done it now. The team he picked against Watford, Ramsey was left out of the squad completely, and they left players on the bench as well. So clearly they're going for the Mourinho all eggs in one basket for the Europa League approach now. They're through against Milan, I think, barring a ridiculous collapse, but I think they are. And Rafa's absolutely right. There is only Atletico there that they will fear. And it's very strange because I don't think the Wenger should say, and there's very few Arsenal fans do, but Jose Mourinho last year won a League Cup and Europa League and finished sixth in the league. And Wenger will finish sixth in the league. And if he wins Europa League, then there's only the League Cup as the difference between those two seasons. Mm. And Manchester United fans sold that up as a good season. I know that clubs are moving in different directions, but I think this, if they win Europa League, that's one of Arsenal's best seasons for a decade, weirdly. Yeah. And yet, I still think he should go.
Paul Scholes is my hero. Says, can AC Jimbo show genuine surprise as Arsenal do a number on AC Milan? Also, why did Milan lose? Well, I think Arsenal were great, but Milan didn't play very badly. That was the weird thing. They are a team that were playing their first knockout match in 4 years in Europe and very, very inexperienced, which I think may kind of suggest something about why they weren't able to break back. But also, I think this is part of the problem with Serie A, is that the football's by and large pretty good. It's the finishing. And I think this is where Serie A has been hit largely, is in the, you know, the big name scorers up front. I think the amount of chances and opportunities that Italian clubs have, I mean, certainly in that game, I thought that they actually played pretty well for kind of three quarters of the pitch, but just never really kind of mounted a serious attack.
I completely agree. I think the individual quality of Arsenal, a team that are in a similar position to Milan are in Serie A, Arsenal by miles have better individual players. I mean, it's not always the right thing to say, but you look at Milan's team and very few get anywhere near the starting 11 of Arsenal. And this is an Arsenal team that have problems in a lot of positions. So I think the difference in individual quality is quite vast still. Mm. Can I just say one thing?
Because
you asked about Alexis Sanchez and Mesut. It's become a bit of a joke, I think, to kind of laugh at Arsenal because they they made the noises of, finally we got rid of Alexis Sanchez and look what's happened to them. But I think it's been underreported just how badly that the whole dressing room hated Alexis Sanchez. They really felt that he was just playing up to camera, doing all these things like, oh, I'm trying, but no one else is, what am I doing here? And then quite tellingly, Wenger, and he talked about this last year, if you go back, Arsenal, they put up stats inside the dressing room after every game showing the amount of kilometres run, the passing and so on. And Sanchez would regularly come out with the lowest mileage by a big distance.
Really?
And the players would just absolutely, go bananas at him playing to the camera and just making all these moves of, oh, they're just not worthy of me. What am I doing here? So they really wanted to get rid of him. Whether they've improved as a team is a different story. But I think it is a happier dressing room, no doubt.
Ozil's player who gets a lot of stick, but he, on Sunday, became the fastest player to 50 Premier League assists. So he's worth a little bit of praise as well, I think.
Certainly. All right. Europa League returns on Thursday with Arsenal defending that 2-0 lead at home to Milan. Very nearly wasn't enough. Their 3-0 win away at Östersund, of course. So, nothing's over till it's over with Arsenal, but we'll see.
And they almost, in the Champions League game, they almost did the reverse when they lost 4-0 in Milan and then beat them 3-0 at home in the second leg as well. So, Arsenal are a club that can find disaster in any corner, but I think they'll probably be absolutely fine. None of the players that they will rely on Thursday tested themselves or particularly strenuously against Watford, so I think they'll be fine.
Right. I wonder if Petr Cech saving a penalty for the first time in his Arsenal career will mean that he'll get to play on Thursday.
Ooh. Mm. Was that the first ever time?
16th penalty he'd faced for Arsenal, first one he'd saved.
Okay. Atletico, anyway, favourites to win the trophy currently. 3-0 winners at home to Lokomotiv Moscow. Lazio got held at the Olympico 2-2 by Dinamo Kiev. Lyon beat CSKA 1-0. Marseille beat Athletic Bilbao 3-0. It was quite a shock. As was Salzburg beating Dortmund.
Hugely embarrassing result for Dortmund and for Peter Stöger, who's Austrian. Ah. And for any German team to get beat by an Austrian team is always bad. For Dortmund, it was particularly bad because they effectively boycotted some of the marketing around this game, saying we don't want any half and half scarves with our logo next to a drinks company. And they got beaten in a competition that they don't have to win because they look well placed to make the Champions League through the league, but would like to win. They've got a tough second leg now to turn this around against a very well coached Salzburg team by Marco Rose, who's really one of the up and coming coaches. Incidentally, one of those guys who grew up under Wolfgang Frank and Jürgen Klopp at Mainz.
There you go. There you go. So, yeah, as you say, they're well-placed-ish. They are third right now in the Bundesliga, where it's tight. You've got obviously Bayern top, then Schalke. Dortmund are a point behind them, and a point behind them are Leverkusen with the exciting Leon Bailey. Oh, then you've got Eintracht Frankfurt, bizarrely, in fifth place after a massive win for Dortmund, who against Eintracht Frankfurt, who were the big surprise.
Yeah, last-minute goal from Michy Batshuayi. He came on, he scored two goals. His finishing is off the charts. He's so good. Dortmund, again, really played quite poorly after a good start and a great opening goal, which was an own goal, but it just came from a beautiful move from Christian Pulisic. And Frankfurt are the kind of team where you find it very difficult to explain why it is that they are up in the Champions League places, but they're very physical. They don't give away a lot. They have the second best defense in the league. They are very efficient. They win games with very few goals, and they were well worth that point and really unlucky to come away with nothing. And I think for Dortmund, even though it was a win that cements their position in the top four and buys a bit of breathing space and time again for Peter Stöger, I think really have to make up their mind whether he is the right guy taking this team forward, because they have so much quality on the pitch, especially in the attacking positions with Royce coming back to his very best. But there is very little by way of a cohesive game, a rhythm, a kind of dominance on the ball. It's all very bitty and intermittent. And uninspiring, really. And Royce was asked after the game, you know, this was much better than the Salzburg defeat. And he said, yes, first half. And he said, yeah, well, what about the second half? Second half was scheisse.
He literally
said scheisse.
Crikey.
I think they need to really think hard whether Stöger, who they like because he plays cards with the board, chairman of the board, and has always an open office and likes to talk about the tactics with the bosses and stuff, is actually a big enough manager for this team.
As for the Frankfurt manager, the boys from Frankfurt,
Niko Kovac
bouncing back terrifically from his spell, his less successful spell with Croatia. We better mention Bayern, who looking good for the title ahead of their clash with Besiktas in the Champions League, which they're also looking pretty good for. Was it 5-0?
Yeah, there'll be some players rested because they're on yellow cards. I think there's no Kimmich, no Lewandowski.
Okay,
one more, I think.
And 6-0, just the 6 this weekend against Hamburg.
Now, they've conceded so many goals in their last visits that it's hard to get an accurate figure. Some people are saying it's 60.
What, in how many visits?
7 or 8. Yeah.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. It was 6-0 last week.
8 there, twice,
it was
quite recently.
It was last week. Last year was 6-0.
So this is actually a bad performance
for
Bayern.
There was a 9-2. No, this was just another horrific performance from Hamburg, who are really running out of time for once after having always been there from the very first moment the Bundesliga was introduced in 63. And it looks as if Bernd Hollerbach, who'd only been appointed 7 games ago, will be fired as well.
He's toast. Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, so he's...
It looks as if Christian Titz, no sniggering at the back, will be taking over.
All right, as they make a clean breast of it.
Absolutely.
Nice. Bayern, Lewandowski got a hat-trick and could have had 4 if he hadn't missed the penalty. And, oh my word, the 5th goal from Franck Ribéry. Rafa, was that the goal of the weekend?
It wasn't quite. It was certainly the goal at the Allianz Arena, and it was Franck rolling back the years, but against a strange kind of non-physical, non-presence from Hamburg. It looked a little bit like that phantom punch, you know. It just goes through.
Oh.
It just goes through players.
Yeah. Lovely goal.
Lovely goal, and good for Bayern, because without Kingsley Coman, who's injured, sadly, and won't be featuring much before the end of the season, if at all, they need, once again, those two old guys, Ribéry and Robben, to produce if they want to do anything in the Champions League.
All right, very nice. Of course, Jadon Sancho, Ademola Lookman and Reece Oxford, how are they getting on?
Generally speaking, they're doing very well.
Right. This quote, we wanted to talk about this another time and we ran out of time. Borussia Mönchengladbach sporting director Max Eberl saying recently that in Germany they follow every English national game, the under-16s, the under-17s and so on. They know every top player in England. And he's saying that age group of 1999, 2000, 2001, you could take every player. It's unbelievable. For me, says Max, they're the best in the world of that age group.
There you go.
Competitions are kind of bearing them out at the moment.
It's irony to Germany being the ones to do more than England to win as the World Cup, but... Good.
No, but yeah, Bundesliga can be the finishing school for these guys who have a very hard time getting into their respective teams. I think Jadon Sancho was very, very smart to go to Dortmund, where he's, of course, he's not a regular just yet, but he has seen quite a few minutes on the pitch. If he'd been at City, I think it would have been very hard for him.
And Big Sam spitting feathers, of course, over Ademola Lookman's decision to tread a similar route. We're going to stop there, come back with some of your questions, more goal of the weekend contenders, more other leagues business, and more, of course, from the Premier League. Wowzers.
Listeners, if you want to combine your knowledge of the footy with your knowledge of the footsie, then you need to get yourself over to the Football Stock Market Football Index. Football Index is a new way to profit from your knowledge of the Premier League, League One, Serie A, La Liga and beyond. Buy and sell players, build a portfolio, earn dividends and sell at a profit. Because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can try Football Index and trade up to £1,000 entirely risk-free. Just head to footballindex.co.uk, enter the promo code TOTALLY, and if you don't love Football Index, you'll get a full refund with their 7-day money-back guarantee. Download the app or play online at footballindex.co.uk and become a football trader today. T's and C's apply. You must be over 18. Deposit required and please trade responsibly.
This time next week, next Monday, that's what I'm saying, people, we're going to be in Dublin Ireland's Fair City, for our live show with Pat Nevin. Due to phenomenal demand, I'm happy to say we released another batch of tickets. Is that genuinely what happened, Producer Ben? Or are these the ones that were there anyway? No, apparently it's a fresh set of tickets. You can get your hands on them at ticketmaster.ie, but only if you're quick. Captain Beardy Man FM would like a shout-out or a Goo-Blaine because he's doing training for the London Marathon.
Go on.
Go
keep
on,
going,
Blaine. Hey. Oh, mind that.
Oof. Don't you charge for this usually, James?
No, no, no. Daniel Schilling, following on from the solid colour stripe stat from last week, when was the last time a team won the top flight wearing stripes?
1935-36, Sunderland. I followed the tweet conversation that he tweeted back to us and someone answered his question very kindly. So I've made myself sound clever, but then admitted it.
Take that bit out, Ben. Of course, it happens every single year in Italy, but that's different, isn't it? That's remarkable. So nobody's won wearing stripes since, Daniel?
1935-36, apparently, Sunderland.
Crikey. Mr. Podge says, after Sergio Ramos's bathroom break, what other toilet-related incidents during a football match spring to mind? I can think of Lineker, Lehmann and Solskjaer to start. Now, first off, this is Sergio Ramos, who left the field kind of with a newspaper under his arm in the 76th minute for Real Madrid against Eibar, did his business and came back out again, which is phenomenal strength of mind and purpose, because I don't know if, I mean, you know, that kind of pressure necessarily facilitates the performance of what?
The version I heard was that
he'd already done
a la Lineker.
He'd already
done it. It was necessity rather than choice. Yeah.
That makes a lot more.
Jason Puncheon left Southampton, didn't he? He left the pitch and came back on again, having excused himself. And the supporters were chanting, he shices when he wants.
Oh, there you go. That's nice. But the question about which other toilet related incidents. So Lineker, yeah, absolutely. Lehmann behind the advertising hoarding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Solskjaer, what did he do?
I don't remember Solskjaer.
Do you remember? Does anyone remember what Solskjaer did?
No.
Okay.
There was a
pistol over Bayern Munich's defence in 1999.
That'll be the one.
There was a non-league story not long ago.
The keeper, wasn't there?
The keeper went in his net and was booked for doing so.
Yes.
Was it who Salford United were playing? Possibly.
It was, yeah. Salford City versus somebody.
Salford City,
and the keeper. The keeper took an unscheduled break and got booked for it.
Yeah.
Not quite on the
what are you going to do? Of course, in cycling, they do that all the time. But equally, they are likely to be fined if they do it if they do it, say, coming out of a feed zone where there's lots of people around and all that, and they get their business out, so that they're encouraged to do it on a less popular
I guess the goalie was kind of risking flashing, I suppose, wasn't he?
Of course, it's not the only problem regarding urine and cycling. But
apparently, in swimming, it's a big thing.
Well, I suppose it would be.
Generally in public pools.
Even professional swimmers,
right?
They admit, there was a big article, I think it was someone who won a medal, that you basically swim through loads of stuff because people have no time to
clean the pool,
to get out of the pool.
I would imagine rock climbing would be an issue as well.
Why?
Well, you know, you can imagine if you're the next man up and this stuff comes, the guy above you.
Is that one of your weird dreams, James?
Anyway, moving along, Thomas Burkhan says, please talk about Per Mertesacker's interview with Der Spiegel and give your views on his comments about the pressures of being a professional footballer. Pressures that led to him being sick.
Yeah, he, for a number of years, had like a gagging reflex before every single game, had to go to the toilet all the time. Just even not actually feeling it as a pressure, but the body was basically saying, I don't want to be here. He dealt with it because, you know, every single game it happened to him, but he'd almost forgotten about it. But the fact now that he's about to retire and he's preparing his autobiography, full transparency, I'm writing it with him. He started to think about these things and basically kind of acknowledged them to himself.
When did this pressure stop? Was it when he moved to Arsenal?
No, it did not. It only just stopped now that he's no longer really involved in match day squads. He still trains, but one of the things that riled one or two proper football men in Germany is that in the interview he also admitted that now that his career is winding down and he feels he's no longer able to really perform at his best, he's happier sitting on the bench and even in the stands rather than being on the pitch and dealing with pressure that he feels he can no longer live with because his body can't can't perform.
Wow, interesting.
And they took offence to that. And he also admitted to, after the 2006 semi-final against Italy, as much as they were disappointed as a team and distraught about getting knocked out, he felt very relieved because he'd been under so much pressure not to make any mistakes as a 19 or 20-year-old in his first big tournament, that he felt at that moment, he felt relieved that he'd come through the tournament without a mistake.
And that he didn't have to play the final as almost the biggest test of all.
No, he didn't. No, it's not that. It's just that it come to an end with it, without him disgracing himself in front of 80 million people.
Unlike Sergio Ramos.
Correct. Yeah. And again, that was very, very bad because that was quoted back as an isolated quote to some of the experts doing the Sky Live Saturday program in Germany, Lothar Matthäus, Christoph Metzelder, and they reacted quite badly to it, but having really, I think, been done a disservice by their producers and the people in the studio who didn't give them any context of the court whatsoever. But created a big debate, and his book will be out in mid-May.
Plenty of context in that, eh? Sounds like it's going to be a terrific read. Have you got a title yet?
The title is, and it's his own idea, World Cup Winner Without Talent.
How do you say that in German? I'm guessing it's snappier.
Weltmeister ohne Talent.
There you go. Is that all one word?
No.
Andrew Lang. Hey, more top goals, Matt. Don't know if you saw. Did you see Jamie Vardy's?
I did see Jamie Vardy's.
Wow. It was kind of David Platt against Belgium-esque.
No. It was Del Piero against Fiorentina-esque.
Okay, all right.
That's what it was.
Jamie, the thing about Jamie Vardy is that was a brilliant goal, but his first reaction is to go and give some stick to the West Brom supporters. He's a very difficult man to like, isn't he?
I really like Jamie Vardy, and I would say that he's one of England's. You know, when you look.
Oh, he's our central striker if Harry Kane's not playing.
Yeah. Also, Martin Odegaard, remember him? Mm-hmm. From back in the day. He's still only 19. Scored an absolute stunner for Heerenveen against Ajax on Sunday. But did you see Chiro Immobile's goal against Cagliari?
Oh, yes.
Oh, we should also include in the conversation Salomon Rondon, because I don't think that goal got the love it deserved. Basically, it's a cross in from
Ollie Burke.
And the commentator said, oh, he only had Salomon Rondon to aim at, and he put it, you know, he delivered it perfectly. But Salomon Rondon is being very closely marked, and he manages to just stretch a leg round and perfectly deflect this pass into the net. I thought it was his superb goal, but still not as good as Chiro Immobile's, which was how, Rafa?
Chiro Immobile is a cross that comes in, but it comes in behind him. So he has to basically almost run back and stretches out a leg. And then
with the
volley,
heel.
Yeah, volley back heels it in a bit of a loop over the keeper.
And this is in the 95th minute.
Yeah, and this is from 14, 15 metres out.
Yeah.
Unbelievable goal.
They're losing 1-0 and he does this. And I'd love to think that he meant it. But
yeah, he did.
You think
it.
So?
Yeah, because there was nothing else. He wasn't able to try anything else apart from actually directed towards goal.
Unless he was just wildly swinging a leg and it happens to hit the precise bit of his heel. But
it was
an amazing goal. We'll compile links to all these and put them on our Twitter feed. Sorry, Rafa.
I still think that Vardy's goal is technically more difficult and more pleasing.
Because of the assist and the finish.
With his weaker foot as well, the finish was.
Yeah. That's true. Let's get a little bit of news. Of course, that goal came as part of Leicester's 4-1 victory against West Brom, which also, of course, featured that Rondon opener. Everton beat West Brom. But no news there. Everton beat Brighton 2-0. That's 2-2 now for Cenk Tosun.
That was a love in off the bar as well.
It was a slight deflection. It was rare that a deflection makes a goal look better, but it definitely did then.
And another goal for Brighton's top scorer as well. Actually, I say top scorer, but they're behind Glenn Murray. But
Uchi,
bong though this time.
Horrible tackle from Knockhart as well on Leighton Baines. Goodness me.
But that's nominative determinism, isn't it? Really, right there.
There's a funny one with Knockhart, because speaking to a Brighton fan I know well, he and very many other Brighton fans are well aware that Anthony Knockhart is going through a heck of a lot in his personal life at the moment. And has struggled to cope with the loss of his father for an extended period of time. And there are Brighton fans who will be pleased that he is out of the limelight and out of the team for a few games, because as soon as Brighton are safe, they are of the mind that he shouldn't really play for them, should be rested until the end of the season, because he's struggling. And it's a tribute to one of the sort of breakout stars of the season coming from the Bundesliga, Pascal Gross, who has taken on Knockaert's, not his goal scoring from last season, but certainly taken on his creative influence, and has been probably the best bargain signing of the season in the Premier League.
Yeah. I mean, although Mo Salah, even at that price, is
fine. I mean, he was £2.5 million from Ingolstadt, so it was a fine.
Does he? Huddersfield had a 0-0 draw with Swansea. Huddersfield who take on Palace this coming weekend. That's the 16th game without scoring for the Terriers. Despite having 82% possession,
Second highest figure since Opta started doing the possession stats in a Premier League game. That's
remarkable. Mm-hmm. And they're usually on the other end of those stats, aren't they? Swansea, of course, playing with 10 men because Jordan Ayew got sent off. He's going to miss FA Cup game with Spurs, Man United away and West Brom away. And the other game, of course, and the biggest news was Newcastle and their 3-0 win against Saints, moving themselves 5 clear of the bottom three. Daniel?
Yeah, it was the performance they needed. Newcastle have been better away from home than at home this season. Rafa Benitez, how he is as a managerial personality, prefers to play without the pressure to attack, and the Newcastle fans would like to see their team attack more. It's clearly their strength lies in central midfield and defence anyway. But they got at Southampton. They scored very early, which always helps. Kennedy has been a revelation. Because of the purse strings tightened by Mike Ashley, they were only able to bring in loan signings. And yet two of those loan signings, Martin Dubravka in goal and Kennedy, have been two of the best signings in January. They've been phenomenal. And they're not safe yet, but with the running they've got and the running the teams in the bottom four have got left this season, they could well be safe. Southampton are wretched.
Yeah, one of those teams being, of course, Southampton, where things have taken an... Did it feel a bit of a turning point with the manager calling out the players for their lack of effort and spirit?
It's never a good sign, that, is it? As Frank Lampard said on Match of the Day, when the manager questions the spirit, that's never a good sign. They've only beaten West Brom since November in the Premier League.
Oh, my word.
The weird thing about Southampton is they've kind of... I wrote a piece about Football 365, but they basically have not committed to disaster. They lose a few and then they draw a few, and it just keeps the Pellegrino away from the trapdoor, and sometimes that's the worst thing. You know, we've seen with Swansea this season, and possibly with Palace too, that fully committing to all-out disaster works because it forces the club to make a change. Whereas Southampton have just limped along and dropped a place every couple of weeks, and the moment they found disaster at Newcastle, it's probably too late. And with the running they've got, they've got to play five of the top eight in the last six games, I think.
Really?
West Ham, Arsenal, Chelsea, the next three.
I feel like I'm saying every club's going to go down at the moment.
Well, so far you've got West Ham and Saints.
Yeah, West Ham, Saints and West Brom.
Probably West Brom.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. So 1 point above the drop at the moment, though. So still everything to play for. We're going to come back in a second or two because we've still got lots for you, listener. If you want to stick around, you can get the odds, of course, from Paddy Power. You can hear about the Old Firm game, a little bit about Italy, Championship and Dulwich Hamlet update.
Listeners, do you like shaving and looking smooth and clean?
Yes!
But do you enjoy having to go to the shops for new razors and other shaving supplies?
No!
Well, Cornerstone gives you everything you need for a great shave, and they'll deliver it all right to your door. Cornerstone's super sharp, award-winning blades are engineered in Germany, which is always a good sign, and their range of balms, creams and exfoliators are all environmentally friendly, alcohol-free and suitable for the most sensitive skin. Get £10 off your first order and check out the range for yourself at cornerstone.co.uk/totally and find out why tens of thousands of men have switched over to Cornerstone.
That Dulwich Hamlet update, they've played twice since last week. Haven't sorted anything out off the pitch, but on it, they played twice. Oh, their goalkeeper scored a 90th-minute winner away at Brentwood on Thursday. And then Saturday, as you no doubt know, Daniel, they drew 2-2 with Brightlingsea Regent.
They have, off the pitch, they have announced that they're going to ground share with Tooting and Mitcham United, which is, it's at least a halfway resolution to get their games on for the rest of the season, which is the most important thing.
And good good on Tooting and Mitcham because they are Dulwich's biggest rival and their other biggest rival, Leatherhead, and they've offered the bar receipts for their takings for this game this weekend to go to Dulwich. If any of our listeners are South East London based like I am, there is a march from Goose Green, which is near Champion Hill, which is all locked up at the moment, on Saturday. If you follow Save the Hamlet on Twitter, you get all the details on that. But families, kids, everybody invited to attend that. I'll be there.
All right. And you could also go along on Tuesday night when they'll be playing Met Police in the semi-final of the Velocity Trophy. There you go. That, I believe, is at Tooting and Mitcham.
Crook plays for Met Police.
Does he?
Yeah.
Crook?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Football, eh? Yeah, at Dulwich Hamlet FC is their Twitter handle. And that's splendid. We've got two Forest fans here. And the Championship fixture list this weekend featured the East Midlands Derby. How'd it go?
It was a pretty terrible football match.
Yeah.
It was one of the... There's two types of game in the Championship, or stereotypical games. One is that it's absolutely ludicrous and goals flying randomly and from all players, and Hull Norwich this weekend was one of those. Hull won 4-3. And there's the other game which starts off slowly and very bitty and gradually builds to a kind of crescendo at the end, but is basically a bad football match. And this was a bad football match. And I say that as a Forest fan who feels sick whenever we play Derby anyway, but... Yeah, it was terrible fare. It was not a good advert for the league.
Mm.
But we didn't lose it. Forest looked much more of a coherent team than they did a couple of weeks ago.
And so Karanka's working out then?
Yeah, I think so.
From what I heard, he was basically two games from the sack after he'd managed for eight games because he'd beaten Wolves away and then lost every other game. And the rumours were that they were already sweating on him. But he demanded 10 players in the last 2 days of the January transfer window. The club went with it because that's what Forest do. And he has, thankfully, addressed the slump.
Okay. Birmingham's new boss, Gary Monk, is in a slump himself. Two defeats in a week this time, 3-2 to Cardiff, who now closed the gap to just 3 points on Wolves at the top of the Championship. Wolves having lost 4-1 at Villa in a massive game this weekend. There'll be more of all this kind of thing in the Totally Football League show, which will be up Tuesday afternoon with Ian McIntosh and the gang. On Wednesday, we will present a new Golazzo, in which we'll be looking forward to Inter Sampdoria at the weekend, talking about Roberto Mancini's extraordinary past with Sampdoria, and also, I think, featuring one of the most remarkable finales to a football game that I ever saw, which was a previous Inter Sampdoria. Details to follow, just to say that this weekend, Inter warmed up nicely with a 0-0 draw against Napoli at San Siro this Sunday night. Wasn't a bad game, Rafa, although you're grimacing. It kind of ties in with the finishing problems. There was some nice football. Just
yeah, I mean, I must admit finishing. I dipped in and out of the game, but it didn't seem to be... whenever I dipped out, I didn't have the feeling that I missed much.
You had
when
to
I
get
came back
in.
Back.
Right. Okay. Napoli, as a result, have now slipped off the top of the table.
And I think that's been so frustrating. I mean, it's always a bit frustrating as a neutral to see a 0-0 draw, but to see Napoli effectively handing the initiative back to Juventus is quite painful. Even though I think we've all begrudgingly come to admire this Juventus, especially after what they did on Wednesday night at Wembley, it would have been still so nice to see Napoli win it this year, and I think they might have thrown it away.
Well, we'll see. We'll see, because, you know, maybe the Champions League, maybe that'll mess with Juve's heads. I don't know. They picked up their 11th win in a row in the league on Saturday. 2-0 against Udinese, both goals from Dybala, who's now suddenly decided to start scoring goals again. France, PSG beat Metz 5-0.
That is so PSG.
Isn't it, though? Mm.
Timothy Weah came on.
Oh, did he come on again?
Yeah, I think he came on again, which is... It's nice.
That is
it's
nice,
a, it's a
it?
Nice story within a not particularly nice club.
Whereas with Scotland, you had that Celtic Rangers game.
I saw a bit of this. I was preparing for another game I was doing, and it's just so much fun. I think the noise that you get when a goal goes in an Old Firm game from the crowd is different to pretty much any other football match. It is so visceral and guttural. It just the whole it had everything. 5 goals, a ridiculous miss. Rangers should have won the game. They really should have won the game, but they couldn't see it out. And Celtic have just got a little bit more quality. And Brendan Rodgers was lapping it up.
All right, 3-2, despite them playing with just 10 men, Celtic.
Oh, yeah, finishing. Of course, a red card as well. Yeah, yeah. The other key ingredient to any match based on rivalry.
They are now 9 points clear in the SPL. That is the football. Now let's get the odds on everything that's going to be happening this week in football. We're from Paddy Power with Ben Green.
Thank you, James. I'm here with Lee Price. Lee, it's Cheltenham week, but we're not going to talk about horses. We're going to talk about the football. Is that all right?
Thank God, yeah. I'm grateful for you for that.
Okay, so let's start with movers and shakers today. United and Chelsea, they've both got their second legs in the Champions League. They're both quite tightly poised. What happens if they both go out of Europe? What odds are you giving on that?
Yeah, they both go out of Europe. Cue massive hand-wringing from the English media. Chelsea, we're massively odds on they go out. They're 1-6, which is hugely odds on. They've got a checkered history at the new camp, but at least they've got a less provocative manager than Mourinho these days. United, though, I think look a bit better. They actually dare to attack on Saturday against Liverpool. We think they're 13-8 to go out. If you want to double them up, they're 2-1, you massively unpatriotic so-and-so.
Okay, and you've got a money back special going on both of these games.
We have, and I think you might want to bet on it, Ben. It's money back as a free bet if an English team wins the match you bet on. And that applies to losing first, last, anytime goal scorers, correct score, and what odds Paddy markets. Max refunds £10 per game.
All right, let's move from the Champions League to the Europa League. Arsenal, they've turned a corner. The season's back on. So they beat Milan 2-0 at San Siro. Is there any way they're going to balls it up at home?
Any other team, you would say no. But if you wanted a final chapter for the Arsenal fan TV era, this could be perfect for it. They tried their best against Ostersunds. Milan aren't a bad team. Milan are 8-1 to go through. I think Arsenal just about hang in and get knocked out in the next round.
Okay, to the Premier League then. It's very, very ugly now at the London Stadium. West Ham, their form is dreadful under Moyes, really. 19 points from 21 games since he took over. And with this toxic atmosphere that everyone's talking about now, are they going to go down?
Yeah, I mean, on paper they look all right. On grass they look awful. And there's one thing uglier than those scenes, it's their form at the minute. We actually think they'll survive by the skin of their teeth. There are four favourites to go down behind West Brom, Stoke and Southampton. So they're 21-10 to go down. Not this season, I think.
Well, I imagine that West Brom are even more of a certainty with you to go down. But what happens, what can I get for them not picking up another point this season?
Yeah, poor old West Brom. I'm almost feeling sorry for Alan Pardew, which is quite something. They're 1-33 to go down. So you've got to bet £33 to win a single quid for them to get relegated. They're gone. Not to win a single point is just 4-1, which is indicative of the situation there. Definitely taxi for Pardew time.
You can get those odds and more at paddypower.com. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. That brings us to the end of today's Totally Football show. It's many thanks to Matt Davis.
Thanks, James.
Many thanks to Daniel Story.
Thank you as ever.
And many thanks to Raphael Honigstein.
Dankeschön.
Bitteschön. Anything else you want to add before we press stop?
Nope.
Okay then, here we go, listeners. Bye, see you Thursday. Or Wednesday or Tuesday if you happen by before then.
The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
Gentlemen, are you feeling a bit crap? Well, you're not alone. Everyone does at some point. But the thing people don't realise is just how common it is in chaps like you and me. Last year, 76% of all the suicides in Britain were male. That's 4,287 men, a figure not much smaller than the average League Two attendance last season. On average, 12 men take their own life every single day, meaning that the leading cause of death for men under 45 in the UK is suicide. But that's part of the problem. There's still a strong social stigma around depression and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and seeking help when they need it. That's why we at the Totally Football Shows are working with Calm. They're the campaign against living miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide in the UK. Every day from 5pm till midnight, they provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. They've also got a website and a free magazine packed with the kind of information you need if you or any of your mates are having a rough time, as well as some cracking stuff on comedy, bands, film and of course football too. So if you are feeling crap, find Calm at thecalmzone.net for support and some straight-up manspiration.